If you checked out the WPKN blogs, you know I had promised to bring a guest up here at 2 o'clock, and I'm going to disappoint everybody by bringing him up earlier than that. I don't know if any of these microphones are properly working yet. We'll find out shortly. There, the red button finally went on. Frederick Kennedy is my guest today. Are we there? Just say some words.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
How perfect.
Fantastic.
Look at that. I can't believe I did that. I'm not always good at that. But that's because a lot of the plugs and dials around here are balky. The reason why I have Frederick up here is my wife and I were invited by some good friends to go down to the Yale Summer Cabaret just down the road in New Haven to see a production of The Trojan Women in English, thank God. And in the background of all this action, I heard these eerie, interesting sounds. And I started to look. We're fairly close up. I glanced around a corner, and I see a symbol suspended, and I see a bow moving on the side of it, you know, like a bow from a cello or perhaps a viola or something like that, or even a bass. And I realized that someone is doing these live sounds, very odd, interesting sounds. And I know I had been to a couple of productions there previously and heard the sounds, besides the acting, in a spatial way, too, that, you know, it's not just as we have in the studio, a pair of headphones or a pair of speakers in front of us or at our ears, but it surrounds us. And, you know, it's a fascinating thing. And I got thinking, well, who's doing this? How are they doing this? Why? What? And I came upon the name of Frederick Kennedy, who was the sound designer in this production. So I said, come on up, tell us about sound design. He's a sound designer, composer, and percussionist. He is at the Yale Drama School now, in entering the third year of his MFA program, where he's going to graduate, as he said, was it the pinnacle or the...
The terminal.
The terminal. The terminal degree he's going to get. After that, forget it, you know. You either make it on your own or die, right?
Exactly.
So tell us about sound design.
Oh, gosh. It's obviously kind of a broad category, but in terms of what I'm doing with it, you could say that it's under the umbrella of theatrical sound design. So there's sound design for film and television and sound design for video games. And there are people who really just specialize discreetly in that. You know, it's like the guys who design the lightsabers and stuff for Star Wars. You know, there's the people whose sole job is to sort of find these really special and unique sounds that become actually pretty iconic when you think about it.
Yeah.
But as you so astutely said, in the theatrical context, what's so fascinating about it is you're dealing not just with sort of a stereo left and right headphone kind of environment that most of us are used to with like listening to music at home or something, but it's about creating and thinking about how sound works in space, in a kind of three-dimensional space.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're designing for the theater, you've got, you know, not just the speakers in front of you. If there's all the audience facing one way in a typical stage, you might have speakers left and right on that stage, but then you'll have speakers on the other side of the stage further away to kind of create an illusion of depth.
Mm.
Kind of in between the audience and the back of the room, because of the way that the speed of sound travels, you want to make sure that the people at the back of the house are getting a similar experience maybe to the people in the front of the house. So then there's speakers that are on the sides above you, subwoofers that are below you to sort of rumble you and make you feel like in the show you saw lots of explosions and things that are happening like that. So
yeah.
You have the ability to kind of create this really rich, three-dimensional, almost physical environment with sound. It's part of what attracted me to it is, you know, hearing that, imagining it in, as my wonderful professor, David Budry, says up in New Haven, hearing it in your mind's ear and then realizing it in real time and space.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I had the opportunity when I was in college to work on the original Moog synthesizer.
Ooh, wow.
And in four channels. Which was wonderful. We had these four big Klipsch horns in the corners of the room. And I learned to make sounds, you know, go around us, underneath us, above us. And in one instance, I really freaked out my professor too. I don't know how I discovered it, but these waves colliding all of a sudden made your eardrums just wiggle. It was a strange thing. And, you know, you didn't hear the sound. It was just like, wait a minute. What are you doing? So where did you start on this whole thing? What was the first, you know, incident or experience you had?
Well, my background, I mean, as you said, I'm a sound designer, composer, percussionist,
yeah.
But I would say that for most of my life and career, the order of those things has been in reverse. So I started playing drums actually when I was 8 or 9 years old and was immediately fell in love with music as a kid. My dad had a lot of wonderful jazz records and was a drum fan. He'd sit me down in front of the stereo and play Take Five, and I'd listen to Joe Morello's big bass drum. It was, you know, mesmerizing. And so I took private lessons and I got into that. And, had aptitude and continued to get better. And by the time I was in high school, I was, you know, getting permission from my parents to go downtown and play in clubs and starting to do recording dates.
So you grew up around this area?
Actually, no. I'm sorry. I grew up in Nova Scotia. So
what was downtown?
Downtown was down by the harbor. So lots of Navy bars and sea shanty clubs and this kind of stuff. But a lot of music and still a lot of opportunities to be out there playing.
Uh-huh.
But my brother was sort of leaned more heavily towards theater. And my parents also took me to plays and stuff. And so I kind of had this ancillary relationship to doing that sort of work as well.
Mm-hmm.
And actually dropped out of school for a couple of years after high school and worked as an actor and a musician. So I was playing 6 nights a week, but then also going on auditions and doing bit parts and film and TV. And kind of at that point, didn't really know if I was more interested in pursuing the theater thing or the music thing. And eventually wound up going to music school, and that kind of became my career for a long time. I felt like I had to concentrate on it, but I would go and take time off to go work on plays or do projects. Or, I mean, what it comes down to is actually that the quality of the sound has always been the more interesting thing to me than the how, you know, burning the performance is.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, we should tell our audience, by the way, that what you heard on that last cut was you playing the drums, too, actually.
Yes, that's right, correct. That's a live set we did with Stephanie Nellis' band in Germany about 3 years ago, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you got a Bachelor of Music with honors, as you say, from the University of North Texas. Isn't that a huge wind ensemble place and marching band place?
And exactly, yeah. It's actually, I don't know if this is still true, but at one time it was the largest music school in the world.
Was it?
Yeah.
Really?
And I think the music school alone, when I was there, it was at least 2,500 students.
Whoa.
Including 100 percussionists in my first year alone.
So was it a little competitive?
It's extraordinarily competitive. If anybody's seen the film Whiplash, it is in no small measure, and I'm sure I'll get flack for this from people I know at North Texas, but inspired, I think, by that program. And certainly, you know, every single semester, multiple auditions, and the results were posted on a big wall where everybody could see who made the cut. And there were always fewer spaces than there are people.
Of course. But that's the real world when you get out.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the philosophy there, was to sort of have a pretty bleak and kind of challenging experience to sort of in some way steal you for maybe what's to come.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's maybe a middle ground. There's aspects of that that I'm sort of glad that I had that experience. And then at the same time, I think I saw that it was kind of not as productive for other people who maybe became discouraged or lost their passion for what they were doing with music. Sometimes what happens, I think, is you can get sucked into this idea of competition and you forget why we're making this art to begin with.
No, wasn't that the idea? What's that great movie that, La La Land, too, you know?
Same director. I
mean, yeah. Oh, it is.
Yep, same director.
No wonder. And then they use that guy saying, faster, faster, faster on the commercial. Right? He's perfect.
Yeah.
He's amazing, the energy that he had to put out for that. And the drummer in that is really playing it, isn't he?
Miles Teller is the actor, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure. I don't recall. Honestly.
Maybe he doesn't do all of it.
I don't know if he does all of it. I'm sure there's some overdubbing. But
right.
It took me a while to sort of say, okay, I'm going to sit down and watch this because
brought back memories.
Yeah. You know, I had an amazing teacher there who I owe a great debt to in terms of teaching me how to teach myself, teaching me how to listen, how to think critically. which is what any great teacher does. I think, you know, there's a certain amount of the Socratic method where if I come in and ask a stupid question, it immediately gets turned back around to me. You know, well, why do you think that is? And just kind of continually putting you on the spot, getting you to think and think and think and think. And so I feel like my listening skills, my level of that ability to critique became extremely refined. But then on the flip side, how do you then turn that off and give yourself permission to maybe be not perfect? And it took years of kind of learning to recalibrate, starting to hear the beauty in things that maybe weren't correct or weren't good, quote unquote.
Well, a lot of what you do now, I mean, is certainly not precise, is it? The sound design and all. Or is it? Maybe I'm reading into it.
No, there's give and take. I would say that, you know, at least for my own work, I'm at forever, I think, at this point, going to be somebody who's striving for a kind of precision. I mean, I have a very exacting sense of how I think I want things to sound. You know, if I'm trying to get one sound to fade into another, I mean, I'll run that thing over and over again 50 times, you know, experimenting with various combinations of milliseconds until I experience it in just the way that I want to. So,
but theater never runs on that clock.
Absolutely. Well, that's the beauty of it, in a way, is that even in the midst of all that, there's still something living and something, you know, organic about it.
It's got to be a give
reactive.
And take with the actors.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There'll be sometimes, I'm sure, when they're totally off their timing and mark and stuff, and you have to catch up or slow down or whatever to keep pace.
Indeed.
Right?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and hopefully you're designing some of that flexibility into the design that you make. So, you know, when we're creating a design for a play, it isn't sort of like a record. You know, it doesn't necessarily run from beginning to end. You have something that's very modular, and it's broken up into lots and lots and lots of different pieces. And so how kind of complex you make that is up to you, and to a certain extent the operator, the person who's going to actually be having to hit buttons after you finish your design and you leave and go home. Because I'm not present usually for most of these. You do all the work
you're
in
not.
Advance. No.
Oh.
It's a long development phase up front. Reading the play, thinking about it, writing music, blending sounds with musical elements, and then putting these together into, as I was saying to you before we went on air here, a computer program, which what we use now is QLab. Amazing, very, very flexible program in which you can fire lots and lots of different cues that all go to individual speakers and interact in different ways, and you can, you know, very specifically decide how you want that to happen. So it can be that on this line we fire this cue, but then that runs infinitely until this other thing happens, and then that'll cause it to delay in a certain way. And so you're able to build something that even as the play changes and gets longer and shorter and actors alter their performances, the score, if you will, is modular and kind of you can react to them.
You know, let's talk about that in a little more detail in a moment. I'm Richard Epstein. This show is Sometimes Classical here on WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM and WPKN.org around the world. And let's take a short musical break. Speaking of pushing buttons. All right, your typical everyday music, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what is that that we just heard?
Okay, that is a composition named by Jim Black and his band The Last No Axis. And Jim is an amazing drummer from Seattle, very active in the New York modern kind of avant jazz scene.
Mm-hmm.
That I wasn't so familiar with before I moved to New York in 2003. But I was a big fan of Jacques Dejanet. I don't know how into... I'm sure you know his work.
I know Jacques Dejanet.
Great drummer.
Right.
Mostly known, I think, for a lot of people for either his work with Miles Davis or, you know, for the last 20 years with Keith Jarrett Trio.
Both, yeah.
But a great band leader in his own right, just an amazing musician. And I had always gravitated to his sound, a very dark kind of... dark, dry, nasty kind of drum sound, earthy, organic. I mean, there's all these kinds of adjectives that you struggle to explain sound, which...
Yeah, it sounds like people describing how wine tastes, you know.
Exactly. it's so personal sometimes, it's hard to put into words. But I had a sound in my head, and I think when I got to New York and somebody said, oh, man, you need to go check out Jim Black, and I started to hear what he was doing, and it's... these very heavy drums, mahogany drums, Sonar, which is a German drum company, tuned very, very low. And I just immediately fell in love with what he was doing. And it's so strange and jagged and idiosyncratic sounding. And he's just a beautiful musician.
So, you know, as a drummer, you have your choice of so many, many instruments. And within that, I mean, like you just mentioned, the mahogany. I never really thought of it, but, you know, I usually think of drums in terms of depth.
Sure,
but,
sure.
I mean, a physical depth. Yeah, hey, that's a big, long drum, you know. But I'm sure within that there are a lot of subtleties, aren't there?
Oh, it's infinite. Yeah. You know, there's because also diameter actually has more impact on pitch. But then there's the drum head itself has a tremendous amount of effect on the sound. The quality of the wood, how thick the drum is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kind of wrap is on it, whether it's a wrapped drum.
A wrap meaning
if there's almost the way you'd wrap a present. So when you see, you know, shiny, sparkly drums, that's not actual wood. It's a thing that's been wrapped around and then kind of glued and attached to the wooden shell.
And that changes the...
It's going to make the drum a little deader because, you know, it's like putting a blanket around it in a way. So if you have a very thin, natural wood drum, unfinished, it's going to sing and be... you know, a brighter, more open tone. So all you get, I mean, as you know from being a musician yourself, I mean, you can really go down a rabbit hole of sound. And you do if you're somebody who is obsessed with sound. I mean, most musicians are, but as I was, I don't know if it was on air, if I was telling you earlier before we went on, that the sound has always been the leading edge for me versus the chops, the rudiments, the notes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the first thing you hear is the sound.
Right. Right, and the same person can play the exact same piece with the same timing and the same precision or whatever, and the sound will be totally different. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
What's really amazing is I think there's a great story in this Kenny Werner book. Kenny's an excellent pianist, and he has this well-known book amongst musicians called Effortless Mastery. I'm not sure if you've heard it.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty popular amongst improvisers. And he tells this story about Bill Evans going to a party. Bill Evans, a great jazz pianist, and... there's some really just nasty, terrible, busted up old piano. And it's a party with all these famous jazz musicians in New York. I think it was in the 80s or something, maybe, or 70s, I don't know. And everybody's taking turns playing, you know, and it's having a terrible time at the piano. And then he talks about Bill Evans sitting down at this piano, and just suddenly it's like you're listening to Bill Evans just playing the piano. And it's, how is this... How is he somehow taking this broken instrument and like pulling something beautiful and something musical out of it? And there's something exciting too about the way in which, as you really start to understand sound and as you work with different instruments over the course of, you know, decades in your life, the sound becomes part of you too. You know, it's like if you're a violinist or something, it's not just the instrument, it's also how you bow, it's in your hands, it's how you hold the instrument, and you can take almost anything and sort of be yourself.
Right. Well, there's this connection between the physicality of how you caress and touch things to make the music, or, you know, a vocalist doing it with their vocal cords, and you can use any object to do that, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, it makes an individualist in sound. I mean, like someone can listen to a saxophone played by two different people and immediately say, you know, same tune, same pace and all, same backup. Oh, yeah, that's him.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, it's an amazing thing.
We were talking about influences, too, for you. And I think is this musical example you have here that you wanted me to play an influence for you?
Well, yeah, when we were chatting about me coming down here, one of the things you said is, hey, maybe pull some music that has been influential to you. And it's interesting because, like I was saying, for my whole life, I've kind of had this, you know, identity. Like, I was primarily, while I was in New York, I was just playing and recording and going on tour and playing in bands. And so there's this kind of, you know, I have a folder of, here are my musical influences as a player. You know, here, you know, like I said, Jack DeJohnette, yeah. Roy Haynes, Jim Black, Tom Rainey. I can kind of give you this like laundry list of people in a very linear fashion through the century, you know, whose playing has really influenced me. But from a sound perspective, how I think and I'm inspired by sound, that's a whole other interesting thing. And there have been, as I was thinking about you making that suggestion, a handful of things over, you know, really since I was a little kid, of recordings that I was either given or somebody played to me that just, where I can sort of have these before and after, you know, we all have that thing where there was my life before I heard this, and then even though when I was 12, I heard this thing, and it just everything held.
That big pivot.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. So this next piece I think we're going to listen to, if we've got it keyed up correctly here, is The Suburge Cathedral by Debussy. And I took a fantastic class my first year of university in Canada, actually, before moving to Texas. And I had this great professor who just played us all kinds of crazy different kinds of music. And this is a very long programmatic piece of music in which it's this cathedral rising out of the ocean, you know, is kind of the image. And I mean, I hadn't really never been exposed to Debussy before, and it just knocked me off my feet. And then I immediately went and bought my own copy of it. And it's kind of crappy, not very good in a way, but you know, don't turn off your radio. It's that sort of rough quality of the sound of this recording is also part of what I love about it so much. And it's actually now appeared in lots of different designs that I've used over
Great. This is a fairly short excerpt we're going to hear, isn't
it? We can just fade it down.
Well, this has a minute 15. Is that how long it's supposed to be?
Oh, gosh. Do we have the right thing queued up here?
The piece is longer than that.
The piece is longer than that. Yeah. Well, let's
start it.
Let's start it and see what we got here.
Let's see.
In the polar regions, the ocean's frozen crust moves.
This is another one.
I doubt that's the piece you want to hear.
It is. Well, no, but I can talk about that one, too, if you want, because this is a pretty exciting one.
Let's find the other one first.
Okay, it should be right before that.
Right before that. Yeah. Okay, number 5, not number 6. There we go, 6:46. That looks more like it.
Great.
So I think this should be more like it. Yeah, and it's got this... It is an underwater quality, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And what I, especially to my ears, you know, when I was 18 years old, would never have identified is that it's not really in any key. And yet there's something quite melodic, tuneful about it. It's not what you think about when you think atonal music.
No, I don't think of it as atonal.
Yeah.
I think of it as impressionistic.
Exactly.
And he's got the pedal down for most of it, so the ringing hangs on.
Thank you.
It's very evocative, isn't it? And actually, I think it's a whole tone scale more than an atonal scale.
Sure, yeah, that would be the way to put it.
But when you're
love growing up on pop music, it's...
You love the airiness of it, didn't you? Or well, I don't know if that's the right word, but that well, incredible... And interesting for a guy who likes percussion to be influenced by sustain.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, my dad would sit me down and play these percussionist strummers that he liked. Mm-hmm. And he was a real fan of the drums, still is. Unlike a lot of kids, I didn't necessarily... My attraction to music wasn't, hey, I want to take drum lessons. You know, I was very interested in melody. I was interested in studying piano. Immediately, you know, later I was in choir, and then I took piano lessons and guitar lessons, and then I studied opera for a year. And so I was sort of a reluctant drummer. I mean, I loved playing drums. It's great. But
that's going to be your autobiography, right? The reluctant drummer.
Man, well, you know, if I ever were to write one, that would maybe be an apt title for sure. But right. I love the drums. I love drumming. I love the physicality of it. I love how it feels to do. But it's not what's the most attractive thing about music to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the way something like what we just listened to, that kind of feeling, I mean, what I am striving for, I think, in any music I make is that kind of, that sense of this evocative, mysterious kind of quality. You know, you want to just reach out and move people. And the excitement that you can get with drumming, I mean, there's a real shortcut to creating excitement. But I think it's a much more of a challenge to approach playing the drum set in a way in which you can create, you know, deep feeling and emotion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and of course, you've gone way behind that now in sound design, which is where you are currently.
Yeah, definitely. But in some ways, I think, as in the piece you saw, where I was also playing and incorporating elements of live percussion, I'm still figuring out how these two things that I do, you know, kind of interact with one another and relate. So I've by no means abandoned playing percussion or playing drums. It's about integrating these things together.
So this other cut that we were miscued first, what's this one
okay.
about now?
So that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
I think a really key moment for me when I kind of realized that the sound was where it's at was my brother, I believe, got me a book and accompanying CD as a Christmas present. And man, I hope I don't drop the ball on this. I believe the producer of this is Jim Metzner. I can't remember exactly his name. The CD and book is called Pulse of the Planet. And it's actually a website and a series, I think. I just realized when I was looking this up, preparing to chat with you today, run by National Geographic. And these are lots of different field recordings, environmental recordings, strange sounds around the world.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I love those things.
Oh, well, I'd never heard anything like this. And so, you know, I'd already been playing music and taking lessons, and I knew I loved music, and I was thinking about doing it. You know, I was a teenager. And all of a sudden, somebody drops this book on me with this CD, and it's you know, a recording of, like, here are ants amplified 10,000 times, It just blew my mind. And so there were a couple pieces. I mean, the whole CD blew me away, but two of the pieces that I brought with me, one of them is Arctic Ice, which is the one we accidentally started a second ago. And it's
this one?
Yeah. It's
Do you know what happened
to the hydrophone? Oh, I just heard that the glacier finally broke away.
From Antarctica, right.
Horrifying.
So how topical.
So this is amplified ice, and it is topical because what I heard the first time I listened to this is not just ice, it sounds like the human voices. It's screaming, it's wailing, it's just unearthly and pure magic.
Huh. Let's listen to that.
In the polar regions, the ocean's frozen crust moves, and that movement has a rhythm and a voice.
That's ice?
That is ice.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, that was my reaction. Wow. I'd never heard anything like it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, I'm as excited by it now as I was, you know, when I first heard this stuff.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, because, you know, that happened to me many times over in my lifetime. And one of the nice things about being up here at WPKN is I'm constantly bombarded with the opportunity to hear all these new sounds, I mean, whether it be natural or whatever. And actually, I brought a recording today intending to play it later because one of the pioneers of music concrete, which is real sound recorded on analog tape, if those of you who are younger might picture this little stuff. But before, you know, real digital electronics, it was all on this tape. And Pierre Henry, I guess you could say, who's on this album, which is one of the seminal things in my life of learning about electronic music, just died recently.
That's right.
And I was going to play this a little later because of how much of an influence. So a lot of that music concrete is very similar sounding to this natural phenomenon, you know. Wow.
Well, the thing is, I always knew when I started getting turned onto this that there was a place for this kind of sound work in the music work that I was doing. And so what's happened with what I love so much about designing in theatrical sound design, and what you heard the other day, is that there's the ability to both compose music. So all the music you heard in that show, the songs, everybody singing, that's all music that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Including the choral bit at the end and everything. But then part of the music for me is there's also rockets and explosions and helicopters, and there's the sound of people breathing, which I recorded and then moved around the room so you hear it in surround sound. And it's how do those things interact with the music? And so it becomes the whole musical expression becomes about notes and harmonies and sound and textures and environments and how they interact with one another. I mean, that's the sweet spot.
Well, that's it. I mean, you're working in four dimensions, really. You know, the three physical dimensions and the time, and probably some other fifth dimension. I don't know, but
yeah, the soul.
The soul, but it is an all encompassing thing. I mean, it's not like sitting up in front of the rooms and in the room and playing an instrument and just projecting.
Yeah.
What you're doing. So when you want to design something, how does it start? I mean, you know, what's the process that you go through with a group like the Summer Cabaret people?
Yeah, great question. I mean, each process is unique and different. It's also part of what's so exciting about it. It's very hard to just import, you know, okay, let me just do what I did on the last thing, you know, to this project. Because, of course, it's about storytelling fundamentally when we're dealing with plays.
Yeah.
For, you know, generally speaking. And so where it starts for me is actually just with the text. If we're dealing with a traditional play, it's about really reading that play. And for starters, just sort of trying to read it without any preconceptions and see if there's you know, what I would call an impulse or kind of first response where you just have a reaction. Oh, I hear something or I see something here. And that piece that you saw, which is an adaptation of The Trojan Women by a living playwright and actor, this wonderful Ellen McLaughlin, it's written in a way that's very, very musical. The text itself is only 20 pages long. And so you're looking at huge, you know, long chorus sections that are quite poetic. And so it was very easy to imagine right away, okay, I can see that there's elements of this that are going to be very musical. I don't know what it is yet, but starting to sort of think about it in blocks and in chunks. But then it's also about conversations with everybody else who's involved, you know, in the team. One of the other things I love about working in this theatrical context is it's so interdisciplinary and so collaborative. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So in that show, we have a costume designer, and there's a set designer. There's, of course, the director. There's a dramaturg, as we were speaking about earlier. There's a lighting designer. So you've got all these people in the room, and they're all bringing their own experience and their own ideas. And, you know, Shadi Gahari, who's wonderful Iranian director who's in the program as well at Yale, who directed that show, you know, was inspired. She chose the piece and was really inspired by sort of what's been happening in Syria for the last many years. And so mm-hmm. she brought a whole bunch of documentary film for us to watch and research images. And so right away from that, I started to kind of imagine a sound world and what it might be.
By the way, let me just say, we are WPKN in Bridgeport, and I'm Richard Epstein on Sometimes Classical, talking with Frederick Kennedy, who is entering his third and terminal year, no, his third year in an MFA program in sound design at Yale Drama School, and obviously has done a lot of other things, but... back to the Trojan women. And so I, actually, one of the things I wanted to demonstrate some of these things. So
sure.
I said earlier, the thing that really, you know, like sparked this whole thing, what we're doing now, is I looked over and there you were making weird sounds on a cymbal.
Indeed. And
so, I asked you to bring some of these things with you today that you used in that performance or other performances.
Yeah, well, I don't have a lot here. I just have a couple of different things, but I did bring that magical cymbal that you were referring to.
Yeah.
This is a cymbal that I actually purchased on the internet when I was in New York, and it's a kind of dark, trashy crash ride cymbal. For those of you who play drums, you know what I'm talking about. It kind of doubles as both a cymbal that you can hit for accents, but you can also, you know, play time on it. But somehow, and I'm not sure when this was, I sort of discovered that it's really marvelous cymbal for bowing. You can really bow any cymbal. You can practically bow anything. You just get it vibrating at the right frequency and you'll get some kind of sound out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many different sounds and harmonics that I've been able to get out of this, and I'll show you in just a second. In the show you saw, there was a very large concert bass drum in the back, and rotor toms, and a cajon that I was sitting on that I could play.
Now, tell everybody what a cajon is.
Right, so a cajon is a South American instrument that basically resembles kind of a large box that you sit on, but it's a drum. And so the back of it, it's like a regular box, but the back of it has a hole to allow, you know, that allows the sound to escape. So you're basically sitting on this kind of natural amplifier, and then you play the front of it with your hands. If you hit the middle of it, you're hitting the most open part of the cajon, and so you get a deeper bass drum sound. And then if you kind of tap with your finger towards the edge, you get a higher pitch sound, which is, you know, akin to maybe a snare drum. So you've got a bass drum and a snare sound, and right there you have everything that you need. So you can accompany just about any song with a cajon. It's a wonderful instrument I've had for years.
Well, would you do me a favor, because I don't know how the mic's set, just hit the cymbal, make a sound on it, just with it, with anything, your fingers, I mean, just so I know what it sounds. I think we heard that. Okay.
So you can hear from that strike that it's kind of a nice dark, as I was saying, I like these dark sounds, kind of shimmering sound.
And you hit that with what is essentially a padded timpani stick, right? Or something
good,
like that?
Yeah, good eye. This is exactly. This is, I believe, a staccato Vic Firth timpani mallet.
Oh, I don't know my mallets.
No problem. When you want to play drums and get kind of darker, muted, rolling sounds, you would use mallets. And so if you strike the cymbal with this, you get something that's a little softer.
And there's a high pitch and a very low pitch in there sustaining at the same time, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So there's a kind of low rumble undercurrent underneath that. And here's with the tip of a stick.
And then you can play it different places on the top of the cymbal, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah, so that's the shoulder, we call it, which is sort of towards the very edge.
Uh-huh. And if you hit it really towards the center, what do you get?
Meaning like up here?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what we call the bell of the cymbal.
The bell.
Which is a higher pitched kind of ping.
Yeah.
But then there's lots of other weird effects you can get. So one of the things you can do that when I really started to see the weird stuff happening in New York, uh-huh. and up there, was you can sort of play it almost like put the tip of your stick facing point down. This might not be the most pleasant sound for some people, but it's a little bit like the stylus on a record player. So you're pressing into the cymbal and turning at the same time, and you get sort of a...
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you can hear that, kind of like a whistling high pitch.
Yeah, dude. I heard that a couple of times in the performance, actually.
Yep, exactly.
It's very distinctive.
And so now here's the bow. This is, I think, the thing that this particular cymbal is really wonderful for.
Mm. And can you make different pitches with mm-hmm. that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh. I'm getting this on video, by the way, so I'll be able to put this on the WPKN website afterwards.
For anybody who wants to learn how to bow a cymbal.
That's right, that's right. Wow, that was closer. Very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a kind of haunting, beautiful sound. It's become something that's, I hate to say, a little bit of a signature, but I mean, I love the sound. I tend to use it in a lot of contexts, so... On quite a number of records I've done, kind of, you know, jazz records, chamber records and stuff like that, I'm doing a lot of cymbal bowing and gong work. And
well, it grabbed me, I'll tell you. I knew something was up when I heard it. It's not your run-of-the-mill sound.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
What else did you bring here?
Oh, just some random bits and bobs here. There's a finger cymbal, which uh-huh. is like, you know... And so, in real life context, I'd kind of mix all of these together. So you'd have like a.
Ah. Is that a bunch of chain down there?
Yeah. Yeah, I love the chain. I use the chain a lot.
You do it on the cymbal, too?
The chain, I don't know where I got the idea for the chain, actually the thing we listened to first, Stephanie Nellis, there was a piece of hers that I used the chain in a lot. I think we recorded with it, and it was like this jail yard kind of stomp, and it just seemed perfect. So the whole drum part for this song was this, just a chain on a drum with big bass drum. So you'd have the chain kind of rattles as you drop it down towards the drum, and then you end with a big hit, boom, boom. But it's metallic and kind of rough sounding.
Cool.
Pretty cool. Yeah, and then a bunch of shakers. This kind of stuff. Just a little bit of fun toys.
It's fun. What's the most unique thing you've ever played? Let's call it an instrument. Okay, what's object?
Oh, well, actually in the sound design department at Yale, they are in possession of these wonderful... musical sculptures by an artist, a sculptor, an instrument maker, the Bechet brothers. I can't unfortunately remember their first names. Mm-hmm. And there are these very, very strange, large, they look almost like insects. So we have a bunch of these things that are like antiques in the attic in the sound design department. And man, they are just incredible. So you play, they're kind of percussion instruments. You can play them with mallets, but there's one that's a whole bunch of these crystal rods. And with a wet cloth, you can kind of like...
With a wet cloth?
Yeah, you move around on these rods and it sings kind of like an angelic organ.
Well, that's the glass harmonica also.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, once I heard it, I got hooked on it.
It's amazing.
And there was a guy, Bruno Hoffman, who was the world's best, and he played on this array of crystal glasses in front of him. Mozart wrote for that, people like that. It's incredible. What you're describing, too, reminds me of Harry Parch.
Oh, I have some Harry Parch with me on that CD.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Which one? Which CD? First,
I brought the two studies on ancient Greek scales. Cool. That's on the first CD, and it should be 6 and 7.
CD. Well, I have to bring this out just to see which one these are.
Man, yeah. The first time I heard this Harry Parch, it was mind-blowing.
Harry Parch. Now, let's tell people about... And 6 and 7, you said, okay.
Yeah.
Oops, sorry. Let's just stop that. Why don't you describe Harry Parch to us?
Well, that's a tall order. I'd suggest Googling Harry Parch for anybody who's seriously interested. But once again, you know, many sort of freshman college ear-opening, I should say, kind of experiences.
Yes.
And I had a strange... modernist composer professor from one of my first theory class studying music theory, and he thought he'd school us all by saying, hey, you know, you're studying this system of notation that we're all used to in the West, but actually, right. Check this out.
Yeah.
And Harry Parch was an American composer, early to mid-century, I believe, and real iconoclast, designed his own system of notation and theory, which he believed was more accurately based on the ancient Greek systems, 43 divisions of the octave, which is, we're used to 12, so yeah. Just to put
it
in context.
We'll hear the difference in a moment, I'm sure.
Yeah. And he played just these two pieces for us, I believe, and he did these two studies on ancient Greek scales, which are actually... not that infrequently recorded. There's a pretty well-known Kronos Quartet recording of the first of these.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, you hear the difference. It's just like almost crazy, unusual, unearthly sounding tuning. It's not what we're used to hearing musically at all.
And these instruments are what?
I can't remember. The other thing about Parch is he designed and built his entire orchestra of instruments, all kinds of crazy. The cloud chamber bowls.
Right.
The giant marimba, these marimbas that you'd have to play, where you'd have to get on a ladder to, you know, hit the marimba key. Because it was the size of, you know, a van, but getting amazing sounds. These pieces are just a little bit more tame in that regard. But
this is like a harp, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the first. This is not that far off from our normal...
But the second one.
Just intonation.
And he follows up the second one.
It's very pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds Japanese.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think that instrument, if I remember the name of it, could have been a barp. I think that's what he called it. It's a something something barp. But it's actually very pretty, and there's this unbelievable release of that extra tension when you finally get down to a unison note on it, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
much more so than the simple scale, the 12 note scales we use here.
I mean, I almost don't know what to say about it. I mean, hearing some of this stuff as a kid, I mean, when all you've ever heard is, now I've got, you know, an entire lifetime of this music cataloged in my mind. But the first time I heard some of these things, I just fell off my chair. I was like, what is this music from outer space, you know?
Well, that's, you know, I mean, that, getting back to our station, we are WPKN at Bridgeport 89.5 FM. And people may be listening to us from far and wide on WPKN.org. And the nice thing is, you know, I mean, I'm constantly, my ears are being opened by what I hear by colleagues up here playing things. And sometimes they'll call me after the fact or while I'm doing it. No, that mic doesn't adjust so well. You know, I'll hear something totally outrageous and new like that, and wow, another world opens up. So, I mean, for you, you've got the place to expose people in live theater, you know.
Yeah.
So,
well, and it's fun because, you know, I'm able to. What's so attractive about this, about doing sound design, this work I'm doing now, is, you know, you can use all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is literally nothing that's off limits in terms of what I want to bring in to the conversation.
Mm. You brought some of your pieces on these. Are these from the sound design or are these from?
Let's see here. I just slapped a few things on here.
Yeah. Let's listen to something that, you know, you've created here.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the first one is one that I did a couple years ago that I'm pretty happy with, that I produced and helped to arrange.
Uh-huh.
And it's, let's see, it's a version of this traditional Swedish Christmas song, actually, that was for a charity. This is a whole other thing. It's this Christmas song, Jul Jul Strålande Jul. I'm probably butchering this pronunciation, but I there was a period where I was working with this excellent singer-songwriter, Ellen Sigvartsen, who's since moved back to Europe. But she was in New York, and I befriended her and played in her band a little bit, and then she worked with me in some stuff, and we got asked to do this song for this Christmas compilation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very into a band at the time by the name of The Bird and the Bee, and also listening to Brian Eno.
Yeah.
And I liked the idea of trying to take... well, if you know The Bird and the Bee, there's a track on... Oh, my gosh. What is it called? I'm sorry. It'll lose me now. But there was one particular track on of theirs that really reminded me of a kind of very ethereal, spacey, lush, kind of Eno-ish approach. And I thought, man, is there a way we can do this kind of corny Christmas song, but put it in a kind of space that's just timeless and beautiful? And so that was the challenge. So I had her sing the thing, and then I took away the kind of the original harmony, and then replaced everything underneath her vocal with all this other stuff, and then horns and synthesizers and ice. There's ice recordings inside here.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Yeah.
So music of Frederick Kennedy.
Himmelens kroner It might be over soon.
I fooled you a little bit because after Frederick Kennedy's piece featuring that vocal from the Christmas time, I put a little bit of a new piece by Bon Iver on that just because the sounds connected in my mind, which is what happens with me when I'm doing a show up here.
Yeah, I hear that immediately. That's such a good piece.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that was interesting, the piece before, though, at lovely layering.
Yeah, it was a really fun process working on that. I had a couple collaborators, old friends of mine that I've done a lot of writing with, Matt Wigton, who's a bass player and composer in Nashville, and then the horns were my friend Evan Smith, who's up in Portland, Maine, but he actually toured with St. Vincent for a long time, and now he's in this great band, Bleachers. Both excellent musicians. And so I had recorded the vocal in my apartment with my kids running around the background in Jackson Heights. And then Matt was in Germany and I sent him the thing and was like, hey, can you throw some like a synth on this? So there's an acoustic bowed bass with synth bass kind of mixed together. So there's a very crazy, unusual sounding bass. And then there's layers of environmental recordings, like I was saying, you buried underneath these synthesizers and horns. And
you really, you know, those things take multiple listenings.
Yeah.
To really, you know, I mean, the first impact is always, oh, wow, listen to that mix.
Yeah.
And then especially when you've got an explanation and it's like, where's Waldo? You know? Right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You're listening for that. And actually, music today is very interesting that way because there's so much of this electronic overdubbing and production. I mean, it's, you know, in the 19th century, people would be listening to some extreme orchestration, you know, Rimsky-Korsakov or somebody. Hey, wait a minute. That was a flute and a bass, you know?
Sure. Well, I mean, also, like you were saying about repeated listenings, it always kind of blows my mind to think about the idea that, you know, if prior to, you know, 80 years ago, 100 years ago, you heard that thing, you heard it once. I mean, if you got to, you know, Probably. You're only going to hear it once in your entire life.
That's right. Yeah.
So that ability we have now to just hear things over and over again is just this luxury, I think, that we sometimes take for granted. And it's funny thinking about, you know, what we're saying about the layering. You know, I just always think about music. It's like an architecture, you know, mm-hmm. and composition is like architecture, too. But the modern way of making music electronically, like you're saying, is a kind of architecture where you understand like layers and structure and how these things relate and how many things can I put on top of one another before it all starts to fall apart. And it's almost like sculpting with sound.
Are you familiar with David Collier?
Oh, gosh, I know the name.
I think his first name is Collier. You've got to listen to it. I might have brought an example to put on later, but he's a young guy who constructs these pieces, playing all the instruments himself. And there's a video on the internet of him giving erudite explanations of the harmonic structures of these things. And the harmonies are sort of like take six or, you know, very complicated, beautiful chording, jazz chording, you know. But when he starts to describe exactly what he does, you know, I mean, sometimes you're okay. You play a seventh chord with a flatted eighth or something like that. He goes so much further. He takes it up three octaves or something and relates it all together. But the music sounds good. That's, you know. That's the important thing. Yeah. Jacob Collier. That's what it is. Let's listen to one more of your compositions, because I think I'm going to change gears as I usually do somewhere around 3 o'clock, which it almost is here.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So this is what piece we're going to hear now?
Well, you know, we started off talking about theatrical sound design. So yeah. I thought I should share a little bit of something with that. So this is... I just kind of bounced down what was a, you know, 32-channel version of something I did for this Othello a couple years ago at Yale. And it's a Monteverdi piece, Duo Seraphim, that for this kind of weird, abstract Othello is rendered in a synthesizer kind of version, which in the room we experienced in this quadraphonic, you know, surround sound thing where the Moog is like arpeggiator is flying around you, kind of like you were talking about.
Right.
And what we hear in this piece is a snippet of a melody that was sung that then morphs into this Monteverdi piece, and then we morphs into a street scene where all of a sudden we're in the rain. So once you hear the rain, you can kind of fade it out. And it's just an example of how you might experience a piece in a show. So this was the top of this Othello, where the lights come down, you hear this melody. All of a sudden, as the characters walk on, there's this crazy quadraphonic synthesizer music, and then that snaps into a scene in which we're outside standing in the rain.
Cool.
La 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 la.
La la la. So, like doing radio, you have to do a lot of segues, don't you?
Indeed, yeah. Transitions. Yeah.
Transitions. That's a big thing. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, it's a pleasure. Frederick Kennedy, sound designer, drummer, producer, educator, composer, all of those things, and now finishing up a degree at Yale University in sound design and MFA. Been a pleasure speaking with you.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
This is a lot of fun. We're WPKN in Bridgeport. 89.5 FM and WPKN.org.
If I was a bolt of lightning, I would shoot right down and split the sky into an eye. Would be so bright, I would light up the darkest night. Or maybe I'll come back as one. I think it would be lots of fun to zap the earth and strike the sea with a billion volts of energy. And if I was a bird out on the wing, the sweetest song you'd hear me sing, I would whistle sounds like secret words in a language no one's ever heard. The tune around your ear would ring, so mesmerizing you would think that I was something quite absurd, more like an angel than a bird. But today I don't want to be anything else but myself, because today I am a little bit of all these things. There's a little bit of all these things in me. I got on right here in my hand. I'm a lightning bird, wind river man. And if I was a gust of wind, I'd blow around the world three times or so. I would pick up half a million leaves and make a sculpture on the breeze, so beautiful that God himself would want to know how to as well. He'd offer me a handsome price just to be the wind in paradise. And if I was a river, I would be a raging river, wild and free. I would find my way around anything just to get to where I was going. So treacherous would be my wrath, you'd never try to cross my path. I'd run so fast into the sea, you'd see the waves from Mercury. But today, I don't want to be anything else but myself, because today I am a little bit of all these things. There is a little bit of all these things in me. I got on right here in my hand. I'm a lightning bird, wind river man. Yesterday I don't want to be anything else but myself, because today I am a little bit of all these things. There is a little bit of all these things in me. Oh, I got on right here in my hand. I am a lightning bird, wind river man. Oh, hi-ya, hi-ya, oh, hey.
Feeling low down. I don't know where.
That's Jacob Collier, someone I alluded to when I talked with my guest just a couple of minutes ago up here at WPKN. Frederick Kennedy was talking about the quite inventive harmonies and constructions of this young man alone in a room. And before that, something new from Declan O'Rourke, a great singer. I'm surprised he's really gotten a big production here. Lightning Bird Wind River Maine. Man, I think is the name of that from his album In Full Color. I'd like to tell you about something else that's happening here. For those of you who know my show and have listened for a while, you know that Paul Winter is a good friend of WPKN, of mine also, and he's going to be doing something this weekend up in Tarrytown at a unique new jazz club, which is nice, Jazz Forum in Tarrytown. July 14th and 15th, I guess it's Saturday and Sunday. He's going to be working with Brazilian musicians at this club. He's spent time in Brazil over the years, and the name of this new album, I guess, that he's putting out is called My Brazil, with songs by Carlos Lyra, Edu Lobo, Antonio Carlos Jobim, Samba, and Via Lobos, all sorts of great people. So that's going to be at the Jazz Forum. I've never been there, in Tarrytown, New York. If you like Brazilian music, if you like Paul Winter, and you like being in a nice setting, that should be a great thing to go to. I guess you've got to call the facility for more information. That's 914-631-1000. That's easy. 914-631-1000. The Jazz Forum in Tarrytown. And I also talked a little bit earlier about the fact that a composer that I knew from my early days of listening to interesting music, Pierre Henry. Definitely French. So Henri, I am far from a scholar in French, but behind me is music of his, in honor of his passing. And, this is Music Concrete, which was manipulated on magnetic tape, taking real sounds, and unlike being able to sit in a room and press a couple of buttons the way you do today, it took an awful lot of work to take sounds and deconstruct and reconstruct them. So this is one of his pieces.
want you to get together. I want you to get together. Put your hands together one time. I want you to get together. I want you to get together. I want you to get together. Together. Put your hands together one time. I want you to get together. I want you to get together.
Great little piece of music by Robert Moran. And that's from an album that I really like. It's, let me get it here. Let's see. There we go. It's on the Argo label. I got it a long time ago. Let's see. 1995. So it's been around a while. But it's called Dance Mix. And it's got just wonderful brief little pieces by great composers of the time. Michael Torque, John Harbison, Libby Larson, David Schiff, Michael Dougherty, and good old Lenny Bernstein, Bernstein, as he said to me, and John Adams, Leonard Bernstein, the Mambo from West Side Story, which can't be beat in terms of a dance piece. Anyway, Dance Mix, David Zinman, and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra playing that. And prior to that, after the very strange Henri piece we heard in the middle between that and the Robert Morin, was a great little group called Saint-Germain, Rose Rouge, Put Your Hands Together. Just love that. It has such momentum to the whole thing. This is Corey Henry on the organ. Well, I've had fun today. I hope you have too, leaving you with a little boogie woogie from various sources and a little bit of electro swing here. My name is Richard Epstein. This show has been Sometimes Classical on WPKN in Bridgeport. Mark Naftalin is here to take you through the rest of this afternoon. Stick with WPKN and you'll never get tired.
Support for WPKN comes from Grillo Services of Milford, Connecticut, supplying organic topsoil, organic compost, mulch, dumpsters, decorative gravel, and more to Connecticut's residential, commercial, and municipal customers. Detailed information on all their organic garden and landscape services at grilloservices.com or 203-877-5070.
On any day of the year, it's summer somewhere, and that means surfing as well. On Wednesday, July 19th, as part of WPKN's Music on Film series, The Endless Summer will be showing. Take a trip back to the mid-1960s with a seminal surf movie by filmmaker Bruce Brown, which follows two surfers on a surfing trip around the world. The movie will play at the Bijou Theater in downtown Bridgeport on Fairfield Avenue. Just look for the longboards outside. Doors open at 6 p.m., with a courtesy beer tasting from Two Roads Brewing Company. Surf music will be playing in the lobby. The movie starts at 7 p.m., and tickets are $15 for adults, $10 for students. Beachwear is encouraged. So hang 10 with friends and fans of independent community radio WPKN and some new friends from the surfing, sailing, and boarding communities as well. See you on Wednesday, July 19th at the Bijou in Bridgeport for the movie Endless Summer.
This is Hazel Kahn inviting you to tune into Tidings on Wednesday for a half hour of commentary and interviews with American tourists and Indian journalists on the subject of beggars and begging. I'm offering this program again because it seems to me as fascinating and provocative today as it first did several years ago. If you can, please join us on Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Thank you.
A loved one have a disability that impacts your mobility or your ability to work and live independently in all aspects of your life? Access Independence can help. Our advocates work with people with disabilities to overcome barriers and access services in areas such as benefits, transportation, housing, peer support, youth services, durable medical equipment, and more. For more information, visit us at www.accessinct.org or call 203-378-6977.
No matter where you are in the United States, Cancer Care is here for you. Cancer Care is the leading national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help patients, families, and caregivers manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. From help with co-payments to in-person telephone and online support groups, informative workshops, and publications, Cancer Care is there to provide help and hope. Our vision is to be the first place to turn for support by all those affected by cancer. To learn more, visit cancercare.org or call 800-813-HOPE. That's 1-800-813-4673.
Hello, I'm Christine Casado with the Alzheimer's Association Connecticut chapter. We provide help to 70,000 people in our state with Alzheimer's and other dementias and to 175,000 caregivers here in our state. Our website is www.alz.org/CT. And if you need any information about education or classes or just any kind of help, please call our 24-hour helpline, 800-272-3900. That's 800-272-3900.
Sterling House is a multi-service community center located in the heart of Stratford, Connecticut. Sterling House services more than 13,000 children, teenagers, and adults per year by providing child development services, community services, positive youth development services, and adult programs to the residents of Stratford and the greater Bridgeport area. Sterling House also houses the largest food pantry in Stratford. To learn more about